In our Strumpet City version of Lockout, it seems we've decided to tell just part of the story, and sometimes to perpetuate myths. The voices of the 400 employers and the city's middle and upper classes are excluded.
Under the gaze of a workers' leader, the presidential wreath is laid in silence. 100 years since
this year's commemoration has been largely driven by the trade unions.
Jim Larkin fought employers for better conditions in a city of slums, disease and poverty. 100 years since they were battle charged.
So I'm over at the Irish Business and Employers Confederation to meet the chief executive Danny McCoy and get his take on the lockout anniversary.
Well, I think the human aspect of this, I think, was probably caught up in the emotions of September 1913 poetry or the Strumpet City miniseries. So we see the grinding poverty of Dublin during the lockout. But what's not acknowledged, and even today, is that the capitalist model is what created the wealth to free our society from that appalling contemporaneous vista that existed in Dublin at that period. Well, I think as a society we always like to celebrate glorious failures. I think there's an Irish tradition of that. And so that probably fits into that mould that we don't see who were the victors from 1913, which were the employers, albeit at a huge human tragedy cost. But ultimately, it was a period of revolution, and it was a period that put us onto the right track to benefit from the way the century was about to unfold, which was the century of the corporation. The great corporations of the world, as we can think of the Fords, the Coca-Colas, and into the modern day that we embrace, the Intels and so on. But listen, the Kerry Groups, the Ryanairs, the Glanbias, indigenous multinationals that had their seeds going back to those merchant princes of that time, to the William Martin Murphys, so that there's a dynamism in capitalism that gives people the chance to fulfill their destiny. And I think that's what was unleashed in 1913. But the history books just look at it statically and say you have a winner and a loser, and the winner was in the stronger position to start off, and so that's not to be celebrated. I think it is right that we give fair truck to the William Martin Murphy aspect and on the path it sent us on. Some of the tactics and so on that took place at the time could not be commended because they brought about real human misery to people who were suffering at that time.
Both Danny McCoy and Kevin Myers see hypocrisy in how we mark the anniversary. We're happy to benefit from capitalism, but not keen to tell its story.
We have an entirely false prism through which we perceive the events of 1913. That prism informs most of the trade union perceptions. It informs most of the educational perceptions. If you want to look at the author of prosperity in Ireland, it is the kind of entrepreneurial culture that William Martin Murphy represented, of which was barely a single representative in the succeeding generations until the 1960s. And that was Ireland's tragedy. And another of Ireland's tragedies that people revered, the likes of Larkin and the likes of Connolly, who were stuck in a sterile cul-de-sac of Marxism and syndicalism. When Ireland had an oversupply of labour, it made no sense to seek industrial action. You will always find people who will break strikes when they're hungry.
I think if you look back on that, that was a revolution. It was a revolution around capitalism. And most people, when they hear the word capitalism, have already got a negative connotation. The capitalist system is what's delivered the standard of living and the capacity for us for actualization of all that we want through education, through prosperity, through travel, through immigration, all the ideals that the international solidarity movement profess to cherish has actually been delivered here in Ireland by embracing of capitalism and foreign direct investment and globalization. And I think that the revolution that set those seeds in place go back to 1913. Tragic as it was, the outcome put Ireland onto a path that I believe has ultimately proved to be successful. It was delayed by the kind of self-sufficiency and the tragedies of the Civil War and the War of Independence. But by the time we get back on track in the 1950s, Ireland starts to head towards modernity. And now today, even despite the crisis we've been through, we remain one of the richest countries in the world.
But that 21st century prosperity goes hand in hand with the social inequity that Peter Sheridan and Neil Crowley discussed. And for David Begg, the General Secretary of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, the labour issue today is not about crushing capitalism.
It's not communism versus capitalism. That's not the argument anymore. It's about varieties of capitalism, in fact. And varieties of capitalism means capitalism tamed in certain circumstances where it is responsible to the community, that it cannot exist outside of the democratic will of the people. You do need a social market economy. That's what it's all about, and that implies regulation.
That idea of a tamed or regulated capitalism is often seen as the rights-based culture of the European Union, where workers and citizens have gained and secured their rights politically and legally. And if workers' rights are guaranteed, the power of trade unions diminish.
There is a difficulty for an element of the broader labour movement, if you like, in that the unionised side of it is less relevant now to people than it was in the past, because their rights are enshrined in law, or they're now sufficiently educated that they will pick up the phone to their solicitor before they'll pick up their phone to their union shop steward. Is that a defeat for unionism, or would Connolly and Larkin celebrate it? I think on balance they would recognise that the equal education that the children of working people are now getting, that middle class people took for granted before, has given them the self-confidence to act out their lives as they see fit. I don't know of any kind of progressive working class parent who wants their children to be working class. You know, they want their children to have an education that they couldn't get or didn't get. That's the path I followed. Neither of my parents went to university. They wanted all of their children to go to university and go to education. And I think it's a normal aspiration amongst most people that you want for your children more than what you had for yourself.
Rory Quinn. But Quinn's version of being Labour in 2013 is not shared by everyone. Aoife Breslin is not just the great-granddaughter of Jim Larkin, she also carries his political mantle. She's a Labour councillor in Athy, County Kildare. And while she's proud to celebrate Larkin and the lockout, she thinks it's a time to reflect.
I think we're at a crossroads at the moment. I must say it's probably the hardest time in politics that I've ever seen. It's very difficult. I think Jim Larkin, if he was around today, would be roaring and shouting. But I think we're in a different time and a different era. And I know a lot of people would say, and I remember when I was quite young, and the militant tendency of the Labour Party were very active. And their big thing to me at the time was, you're a great-granddaughter, big Jim Larkins. You're in the wrong side of the party as such. You have to be in to achieve and to change. And there was a time for Jim Larkin, and Jim Larkin set the standards and it was a bearer. But then you look at young Jim Larkin, totally different type of person. Brighter person, I would think, much more intellectual, much more accommodating, much more thought out. So that era needed young Jim. And I think this era needs more conciliation. It needs better thought out plans. And we need to get out of this mess that we're in. And I will say being a member of the Labour Party is extremely difficult at the moment. I'm only a small member of the Labour Party, but I work within a constituency office that's open to the public every day of the week. And we have people coming in and out all the time with problems and issues. And it is the hardest time of my time to be a member of the Labour Party. I'm still very proud of the Labour Party. I'm very proud of what the Labour Party has achieved. But I do think we need to look at ourselves. There are very serious questions that the Labour Party needs to ask.
It's true to say that 100 years after our formation, we're in a very difficult position in government due to the economic situation, due to the inherited recession, the inherited bailout and troika and so on. So there's no doubt it's a very difficult time to be in government.
For Labour Senator Ivana Bacic, while it's a challenging time to match both idealism and action, it's also an opportunity to achieve social change on things like gender equality, same-sex marriage and compensation for those in Magdalene laundries.
So I think while it's hugely challenging being a small party in government now, and certainly small parties have suffered in the past for being in coalition, it's difficult when the ideologies of the parties clearly don't quite match. Yet, you know, Labour and Fine Gael are both very committed to getting us out of the economic mess we're in and restoring our economic sovereignty. And I think if we can do that and at the same time bring about significant social changes that are aimed at increasing equality in society, then we'll have achieved a good deal.
But just how relevant are trade unions today? We've seen strikes throughout the recession, not just about pay and conditions, but workers fighting cutbacks, trying to save their jobs or seeking redundancy payments.
Dispute between the former Vita Cortex workers and management.
But nothing on the scale of the early 1970s, despite the recession.
The shift workers will be returning to work this afternoon, bringing an end to the 15-day-old power strike.
In reality, less than 30% of Irish workers are in a union, and those in unions are more likely to be public rather than private workers.
So what has happened in the success of the labour movement has been more on the political side than it has been on the industrial trade union side, because most of the rights that were agitated for and fought for in very difficult battles have now become rights for everybody, so much so that, for example, only 10% of the French workforce are in trade unions. The largest penetration of trade unions still is in the Nordic countries, up around 80-90%. Historically now, public sector unions tend to be the largest component of unionised workers. Private sector workers in the modern industries are increasingly not unionised, and many of them don't see the need for unions because, in fact, they look to their solicitor or they look to their deputy or their senator to have their rights vindicated or to have the law reformed so that their rights are there.
Nearly all filling stations are now closed because of the strike.
Let nobody forget, and we don't have to go back to 1913, the trade union anarchy of the 1970s and 1980s and how they denied individuals rights and individuals who wanted to pass pickets or go to work. So let's not have this kind of revisionism that collectivism is somehow a purer form of development, and capitalism or individualism are bad words and terms that have to be abused. So in that kind of broad swathe of history, the collectivism piece is not necessary because of a lot of what would be required for those individuals, what they sought, has now been delivered and is statutorily provided.
Rory Quinn and Danny McCoy there. So while the commemoration is a time of celebration for the Irish trade union movement, of its origins and its past, it also poses questions for its future. As Aoife Breslin herself says, while people call for a modern-day Jim Larkin, times have changed. In an era of new poverty, of entrenched unemployment, some of the left criticise the trade union movement for Croke Park-style deals and demand more street mobilisation.
Well, I think there are small groupings in the state who would say that if you haven't succeeded in getting people out to burn cars, then you're a failure. I don't see the movement's role as that at all. It's the biggest civil society in the state, and it has organised very successful and very well populated demonstrations.
That's Patricia King, the vice president of CIPTU, the union formed when Larkin's two unions, the Transport Union and the Workers' Union of Ireland, merged in 1990.
I think all of us would recognise that in the last 5 years, in the turbulence both in our own economy here in Ireland and particularly across Europe, but it extends further than Europe, a dearth of conviction by policymakers. And that is very scary. And that is something that has caused, in a lot of cases, the austerity programme. And what we've seen is those policies being made and ultimately people at the bottom of the pile being expected to front up and deliver the cuts.
It's people like Patricia King who've been at the heart of the public pay cuts deals like Croke Park and Croke Park 2, often earning her the wrath of workers in the public sector.
Outside the talks aimed at cutting €1 billion from the public sector pay bill.
This is a peaceful protest. There is discussions and negotiations going on here behind us, and we're not party to those.
We're not part of a revolution that has a beginning, a middle and an end. We're part of a progressive movement that very much recognises democracy and utilises democracy to meet our ends, and we're doing that. So I'm not a great lover, I have to say, of the term social partnership. I think that the movement stands up in this country very well to scrutiny in relation to put across the voice and the view of workers.
But both David Begg and Patricia King see unfinished business in the legacy from the lockout.
We have not achieved a legal right to bargain collectively with employers, which was the cause of the lockout in the first case. We have to achieve that. That's a basic human right, which it is just not on to deny Irish workers. Irish workers can't be different from workers in any other European country. And we will not stop until we achieve that. That is one thing we have to achieve.
And that, I think, would be a key point, because we would be saying in Larkin and Connolly's legacy, that's what you achieved. Sorry, we took 100 years to do it, but we achieved it. So I think we have a job to do to fulfil their mission. And we see ourselves in the movement as having that job to do. And I know that we are really committed in this year at the centenary of that dispute to doing everything that's possible to achieve that. So hopefully we will.
It was a woman, Beatrix Webb, the English social economist, who in 1891 named the concept of collective bargaining, the right to have a trade union negotiate for workers. That's now recognised in the UN Charter for Human Rights, but it's still a battleground between unions and employers in Ireland. It's in the programme for government, but there's little action on it, and people like Danny McCoy at IBEC are deeply opposed to it, seeing it as a remnant of the past.
Well, taking the context of 1913, what you had was a labour which hadn't a powerful position and felt the need to act collectively to assert rights. Roll on 100 years and the rights of the individual in the labour market are immense now. The statutory rights for individuals on all kinds of issues, from maternity, paternity, sick pay, unfair dismissals, redundancy terms and so on, that the individuals now have incredibly strong rights that could be wished for back in 1913. And so the absence of collective bargaining did not preclude those developments. In the modern society we now live in, the act of collectivism just doesn't fit with the way our world has emerged and the way that individuals want to live their lives. And so that flexibility for individuals has to be tempered by this notion of collective bargaining rights.
I do think that today there is a very strong resistance by the employer bodies to having collective bargaining. It's immature, in my judgment. And I think less and less can they rely on evidence in Europe, in other countries, to say that they're relying on that as evidence not to do it. In fact, the contrary is the case.
We're not against collective bargaining that's voluntarist, and many businesses in Ireland have collective bargaining, and it works. But it's the one size fits all that's quite damaging.
In a sense, it's our membership of the European Union which transformed worker and citizen rights, and which Rory Quinn points to when the conversation of collective bargaining comes up.
And it was only through getting into the European Union and progressive trade unions who said there is another way of doing business in terms of social interchange between capital and labour. It's the Scandinavian tradition, it's the Dutch tradition, it's the Danish tradition, it's what they have in Germany. And so that was the model back in the 60s and 70s and early 80s that saw us moving towards cooperation and equal rights and bringing working people and their representatives into the living room, so to speak, and having the right to negotiate. In that sense, which tradition has triumphed 100 years on in the year of 2013? Is it the tradition of William Martin Murphy or is it the tradition of Larkin? It's a no-brainer. I mean, he lost, we've won.
Irish people are capitalists. And so it amused me during the burning the bondholders debate that we've just had in recent years. Irish people have been the bondholders. They may not directly know that, but as a wealthy society and a build-up in pension funds, increasingly Irish people have been the senior bondholders. And the notion of those who would want to burn the senior bondholders actually would be rejected by the Irish people fundamentally themselves when the full rigours of what that actually meant was revealed. So we get into this kind of lazy, bad terms. And I think that that polarisation, that the 1913 will be my fear, that we get into a polarised situation on what is actually a false memory.
So while Rory Quinn and Danny McCoy can debate who won or lost the lockout, for Gemma Hussey, it was feminism, the courts and Irish membership of the European Union which improved women's lives in both work and society, tackling things like equal pay and the marriage bar.
Extraordinary. I mean, you'd imagine that would have been one of the first things the trade union movement would have tackled. In fact, it was the social groups who agitated that stopped that nonsense. And the equal pay issue, it was considered that you couldn't possibly have equal pay because it was going to break the country. You have to ask yourself, how many of those did the trade unions achieve? Or did it come about from external forces? Certainly, as of 1973, when we joined the European Union, the women's movement certainly felt that that was a fantastic step forward for women in Ireland.
For Patricia King, it's that drive for gender equality which is at the core of women's trade unionism from the days of the Women's Workers' Union.
I think the suffrage movement played a very strong part. It played a very strong part in Louis Bennett's life. It played a very strong part in Countess Markovitch. In a sense, they started their trade unionism from the suffrage movement. Plus, I think the interesting piece as well, if you take Louis Bennett, who was for 45 years the General Secretary of the Irish Women Workers' Union, I mean, the background there was Anglo-Irish, Protestant, middle class, business background, not what people would automatically expect would produce the General Secretary of the Women Workers' Union, the first president of, as it was called, the Irish Trade Union Congress, and she was president twice in her life.
I'm back at Liberty Hall, looking out across the River Liffey towards what will be a new bridge.
Being built over the River Liffey should be named after the activist Rosie Hackett.
And on September the 2nd, 2013, on the anniversary of the Church Street disaster when seven people died, including a Jacobs worker, Dublin City Council voted to name this new bridge after a teenage girl who led the Jacobs women in 1911 and who was herself locked out in 1913.
Yes, Rosie Hackett, an activist in the 1913 lockout and also in the 1916 Easter Rising.
Rosie Hackett went on to work with James Connolly and Helena Maloney in Liberty Hall, and she joined them and Markovitch in the Citizens' Army in the Easter Rising.
Say that the spirit of the Irish Women Workers' Union lives on.
She's in that photo of the Women's Workers' Union, now embellished on the side of Liberty Hall. And the campaign to give her name to this bridge began with that photo. And in my unravelling of this history, I've come to realise my own grandmother, the dressmaker and tailoress Lizzie Connolly, is in that photo too. And somehow the Rosie Hackett Bridge seems a better marker of the time, remembering not the famous who already feature in the history books, but an ordinary citizen, a woman, politicised by the events of the day, who took a stand for others. As her nephew, John Gray, told us.
I think I would describe Rosie, or Aunt Rosie, as a very extraordinary, ordinary woman. She was a feisty type of woman, but yet she was very kind. She was very passionate about her belief in the trade union movement in Ireland, and obviously followed on that with her involvement in the 1916 Rising. She was a very small woman in stature, but very big in character. She was the type of person that if she seen something that was wrong and she could do something to right it, she would become involved in it and do her best to try and, not just for her sake, primarily for others.